ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, Hamas has announced the dissolution of its governing body in Gaza in an effort, it says, to advance Donald Trump's peace plan. But Israel insists it's all a ruse to avoid giving up its weapons. Also ahead, the billionaire class is booming and most of them are paying less tax than you or I, sometimes close to zero. In his new book, We Need to Tax Billionaires, acclaimed French economist Gabriel Zucman argues this legalised swindle is the greatest threat to democracy in the 21st century.
There's even one year when Jeff Bezos says, look, I'm so poor, I have so little income that I'm going to claim the child tax credit.
No
way.
And
he receives the check from the US tax authority. That's the way the system works.
And Lila Josefovitz first picked up the violin as a three-year-old. More than four decades on, the virtuoso is still chasing the shock of the new.
It's sort of like this ecosystem of creativity where you have one person, so in this case the composer, really needs the instrumentalist, the artist, the performer to bring their creation to life.
An ecosystem of creativity. What a fabulous description. Lila Josefovitz performs just for you a little later. Almost 3 years after Hamas carried out its brutal massacre in Israel, killing close to 1,200 people and taking more than 250 hostage, the militant Palestinian group declared this week it has dissolved its government in Gaza. Hamas, which the Australian government has designated as a terrorist group in its entirety, has ruled over the Strip since 2007. The announcement appears to be aimed at complying with the demands of the October 2024 ceasefire deal, under which governance in Gaza is supposed to transfer to the National Committee for the Administration of Gaza, whose brief is to oversee the reconstruction and management of the Palestinian territory. The move has been met with suspicion by Israel, and the Trump-appointed Board of Peace says it's taken note of the decision, adding its ultimate assessment of the Hamas announcement would be, quote, guided by actions, not promises. Salah Abdul Shafi is the permanent observer of the State of Palestine to the United Nations in Vienna. Salah, welcome back to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you.
Salah, what does this announcement from Hamas signify? Does it mean the end of Hamas in charge in Gaza, or will we, are we still a long way from that?
No, I think it's a step forward in that direction. And this is an obligation according to the ceasefire that was announced last October. I see the main problem is that Israel has not implemented its obligations under the ceasefire agreement. Israel has expanded, in fact, the territory under its occupation in the Gaza Strip from 50% to almost 70%. And Netanyahu announced this. And we shouldn't forget that since the ceasefire, more than 1,000 Palestinians were killed in Gaza, and the killing is continuing on a daily basis. You cannot always require that Hamas implement its obligations while Israel is not implementing its obligations. I think that should go parallel, the obligation from both sides.
And I will come back to that and Israel's role and responsibilities here. But I want to stick with, about Hamas's role in governing Gaza and what that looks like. Because this announcement by Hamas is that it's disbanded its government emergency committee, which has overseen the ministries within Gaza for the past, well, more than 10 years. But the Hamas spokesperson added the ministries themselves and the staff it appointed would stay in place, and Hamas would still oversee security and policing in parts of Gaza under its control. So it's giving up the bureaucracy but not the security of Gaza. Does that satisfy the terms of the peace agreement?
No. Again, as I said, phase one of the agreement does not stipulate that Hamas should disarm. Now, we have...
But phase two does, and that's where we're supposed to be moving to now to allow the committee in, isn't it?
But look, the committee should have been allowed from day one to enter Gaza. Israel has not allowed the committee to enter Gaza. Now Hamas is signaling, saying, please come in, take over. Now, it is a process. You cannot do what the Americans did in Iraq, just, you know, dismiss all employees, throw them to the streets. No, this is a process. Let the committee get in. Let them transfer, a process of transfer of responsibilities and powers in Gaza. And of course, Hamas will not dismantle its police force. Otherwise, there will be chaos. What about the International Stabilization Force? Israel is still, you know, raising red cards against the International Stabilization Force. I mean, this is also part of the process. You cannot leave the place without policing. And I'm not talking about security forces in terms of fighting against Israel, but to maintain law and order in Gaza. Listen, I'm from Gaza. I have guests now who survived the genocide in Gaza. Here in Vienna, my friends who survived came from Gaza. There is chaos. If Hamas stops policing, there will be chaos. There will be crimes. People would be attacking, you know, each other. So you cannot leave such a place where 2 million people have been displaced. Many of them are living in tents. Infrastructure is destroyed. You need a force to keep law and order. And as long as there is no process of replacing the police of Hamas, you know, there is the risk of, you know, a total chaos. Now, again, I'm saying there should be a phased process where, you know, first the administrative committee would get into Gaza, put Hamas to the test, take over responsibilities of civil ministries. But parallel to this, of course, we should have Israeli gradual withdrawal from Gaza, at least from the territories that they additionally occupied after the ceasefire. And then, of course, the issue of disarming of Hamas is a very important issue. And our position, the position of my government, there should be disarming of Hamas. But at the same time, there should be a total ending of Israeli occupation. And there should be one authority, one gun, one authority responsible for security in Gaza.
Salah, you are not alone in your views on this. I sense there's agreement from the envoy who oversees the US-founded Board of Peace for Gaza, Nikolai Mladenov. He spoke to the UN Security Council in May with a warning, really. He said that peace can only be achieved if both parties to the conflict are on board with this process. Here it is.
While I continue to call on Hamas and other Palestinian factions to come back to the table and engage constructively on the roadmap and the next steps to implement their commitments under the comprehensive plan, let me also say clearly that implementation cannot advance through Palestinian obligations alone.
What is going to force a detente here? What's going to end this standoff?
Yes. I think we need, this is the peace plan that was initiated by President Trump. And I think President Trump has the leverage. He has to clearly tell Israel to, you know, abide by its obligations according to the agreement. So we need a strong international intervention, particularly from the U.S. administration, because I think Trump is the only one who's capable of telling Netanyahu, stop, you cannot keep continue violating the terms of the agreement. I think Hamas has so far shown cooperation. Again, since October, there was not a single attack from Hamas against Israel. While Israel is continuing on a daily basis, every day we have people killed in Gaza, civilians killed in Gaza, infrastructure being destroyed in the territories under the control of the Israelis. This has to stop if we want to progress. Humanitarian assistance. Yes, please.
Can I ask you about progress? We've spoken with you before here on the Radio National Hour about the man appointed as the administrator of this committee under the peace plan, Palestinian official Ali Shaath. His committee is operating from Cairo. As you say, it's not allowed to enter Gaza. How involved are Palestinian diplomats like yourself in this process? Are you part of that process? Are you giving advice to the administrative committee? How far along is it in terms of its plans of how to move to begin the job in Gaza?
No, the administrative committee is in constant contact with my government in Ramallah. So there is a close coordination. Yesterday, the president spoke to Ali Shaat. So there is a coordination, and there is a common understanding about the situation in Gaza. We need this committee to get into Gaza as soon as possible. We need the process of reconstruction to start as soon as possible. So again, there is a consultation mechanism between the Palestinian government and this committee. You know, at the end of the day, all of them are Palestinians from Gaza. Many of them has already served in the Palestinian Authority, including Ali Shaat, and they have clear plans, clear understanding of what needs to be done in terms of the reconstruction. But this committee is handicapped. You know, first of all, they're not allowed to get into Gaza. Israel is not allowing them to get into Gaza. And I don't know why. And again, now Hamas is you know, putting the ball in their court, saying, please come and take over. So again, it's a process. They should go in, take over, and then we'll speak about the issue of security.
On that issue of security, the Hamas is currently in control, as you said earlier, and you said it needs to be in place or else there'll be chaos. There are, in fact, around five at least separate militias operating in Gaza in recent times, including the Popular Forces and the so-called Strike Force Against Terror. They are operating against the authority of Hamas. What has this splintering of militant forces in Gaza meant for security within the territory?
Well, good that you're raising this point. We have militias that is being armed and financed by Israel. So, and I am surprised nobody is raising, you know, this issue. How about these militias that are getting their weapons publicly? You know, everybody knows that they're getting money from and weapons from and logistical support from Israel. So why isn't anybody speaking about disarming these groups as well? So we have a very clear double standard here. We have, you know, criticism of Hamas, which is legitimate sometimes. But at the same time, nobody's saying anything about Israel, about the militias that Israel is funding. So again, it won't work like this if we only ask one side to disarm while arming other militias who are cooperating with Israel, while Israel is continuing to expand its control in the Gaza Strip, while Israel is not allowing enough humanitarian assistance to get into Gaza. Definitely, this wouldn't work.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Salah Abdul Shafi, the permanent observer of the State of Palestine to the UN. Is there a danger, Salah, that if reconstruction of Gaza begins without the long-term governance framework and the stabilizing security force, it just leaves the stage open for future conflict? I mean, how do you see the Board of Peace plan evolving into long-term stability and governance for Gazans?
No, definitely there will be no reconstruction without, you know, a long-term vision of stability. Definitely, you know, I don't think that donor countries or those who are willing to fund the reconstruction are ready to put one penny in Gaza if there are no assurances for a long-term stability in the Gaza Strip. And listen, we have our experiences. In 2009, Israel waged a very vicious attack on Gaza. 2012 again, 2014 again, 2021 again. So, and every time, you know, donors would come in, you know, build again, do some projects of reconstruction, and Israel would come and destroy them. That's why I think all of the donor countries or all those countries who are willing to contribute to the reconstruction fund of Gaza say this time we will not put one penny into reconstruction unless there are guarantees, not only for long-term stability, but also for a path to the two-state solution. At the end of the day, Gaza is part of the Palestinian territories and Gaza is part of a future Palestinian state.
Salah Abdul Shafi, thank you for joining me again here on the Radio National Hour. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Salah Abdul Shafi is the permanent observer of the state of Palestine to the UN in Vienna. And coming up, she first picked up the violin as a three-year-old. More than four decades on, virtuoso Lila Josefovic still finds her chosen instrument endlessly fascinating. And tonight, she performs just for you.
The Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly.
We're now living in the age of trillionaires, or make that trillionaire, because there's only one so far, Elon Musk. But with the acceleration of the AI revolution, there are surely more to follow as the ranks of billionaires grows more bloated by the day. According to my next guest, this explosion in extreme wealth exposes the mockery of our modern tax system, where the obscenely rich can use havens, loopholes, assets and political influence to hide their loot. While the number of children living in poverty around the world grows, the middle classes shrink and public services crumble. French economist and director of the International Tax Observatory, Gabriel Zucman, says this growing gap between the very, very, well, let's call it the uber-rich, and the rest is one of the greatest threats to democracy in the 21st century. And he has a solution. Captured succinctly in the title of his forthcoming book, We Need to Tax Billionaires. But is it really that easy? Gabriel Zucman, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Gabriel, I'll admit that the idea of one individual being worth $1 trillion is pretty outrageous, but hasn't there always been obscenely wealthy people? Is there anything much different about this era?
Yes, there is. The rise of extreme wealth has been one of the defining trend of the global economy of the last decades. You can look, for instance, at the ranking, the annual ranking made by Forbes magazine that tracked billionaires all the way back to 1987. Now, in 1987, global billionaires owned wealth that was equivalent to 3% of world GDP, meaning if they had spent all their money, they could have bought the equivalent of 3% of all the goods and services produced in a given year in 1987. Today, their wealth amounts to 17% of world GDP. It has exploded with a particularly fast rise since 2010 and a further acceleration over the last 2 to 3 years. So today, again, according to Forbes magazine, we have about 3,000 billionaires globally, and they're probably missing quite a bunch. In actual fact, there are probably many more than that. But that's those they can track based on the data that's in the public domain. And by the way, there's a great deal of opacity about all of that. You know, there is a blind spot in our economic statistics, which generally have made a lot of progress. We have GDP data, we have some better data on inequality, but everywhere there is a blind spot. There's no official data about the wealth of the billionaires, how many of them exist, the income that they earn, the taxes that they pay. And so that's why we have to rely on those imperfect sources like magazine rankings of the super rich.
Okay, so the rich are getting richer. Let's talk about how. One of the big themes in your book is the rates at which wealthy people are taxed compared with the average wage earner. Can you give me a kind of comparison there?
So that's really a striking fact that was uncovered recently thanks to an international research effort by different academics working in partnership with tax administrations in different countries. What they've tried to do is to compute how much tax the billionaires pay relative to their income and how it compares to the taxes paid by the rest of the population. Mm-hmm. And so what they found is that everywhere, the effective tax rate of billionaire is only half of that of other social groups. The billionaires pay half as much in tax relative to their income than the rest of the population. So for instance, in France is a relatively high tax country. The average tax rate for the average person in France, all taxes included, so not only the income tax, but also VAT, payroll taxes, everything, you take into account everything, this comprehensive all-in tax rate is 50% for the average French person. But for billionaires, it's only 25%. Again, everything included, not only the income tax they pay, but also the taxes that the corporations that they own pay. And so what it means very concretely is that for €1 in France, but it would be the same pretty much everywhere, $1 in income earned by the average person, you have in the different countries 40%, 40 cents or 50 cents that go to the government. That's for the average individual, but for billionaires, it's only typically 20 cents or 25 cents that go to the public coffers.
And Gabriel, how do we explain this? You suggest that our modern tax systems are accelerating this trend. You describe them as inequality machines. What do you mean?
Well, the reason for that is that the billionaires largely avoid the individual income tax. The income tax is supposed to be the way that we make the rich pay their fair share. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be progressive. And it was a big democratic accomplishment that started about roughly a century ago at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, the invention of the income tax, a big revolution. But what we've discovered recently is that this revolution is not complete yet, in the sense that the billionaires have not yet entered the system. Mm-hmm. And how does it work? You know, when you're extremely wealthy, it's actually quite easy to structure your wealth so that this wealth will not generate a significant amount of income or even sometimes any income at all. Let me just give one example. So a few years ago, you had revelations by the US media, ProPublica, on the taxes paid by US billionaires. And you saw people like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos in some years reporting very little income, paying very little in income tax. There's even one year when Jeff Bezos said, "Look, I'm so poor, I have so little income that I'm going to claim the child tax credit."
No
and
way.
He receives a check from the U.S. tax authority. And there is nothing illegal in that. That's the way the system works. If you find ways to pretend that you have no income, to report no income, then you're considered poor by the tax system, even if, like Bezos, you are one of the wealthiest person on the planet. So that's the whole problem.
Okay, so if they can find a way to do it, they will, and it's legal. This is legal, right? This is not people going out of their way to be sort of dirty, rotten tax avoiders using, you know, tax havens like the Cayman Islands. That's not what you're talking about?
Yeah, true. It's legal. And if we continue with the Bezos example, how do you do that? Well, as CEO of Amazon, he didn't pay himself a wage. He also instructed the company not to distribute any dividend. And also, he didn't sell shares in the company, and so he didn't realize any capital gains. And so his taxable income, from the perspective of the tax law, was indeed really low, even though his wealth is very high, his true economic income, his share of Amazon's profit is really high. But his example is really a striking illustration of how, when you're extremely rich, you can find ways to report very little income. And what the studies have shown, and these are recent studies that have been made over the last 3 to 4 years, is that the problem goes way beyond just a few isolated cases like Bezos. It's a structural problem of all our tax systems globally.
And I'm still stuck on the fact that Jeff Bezos managed to get the family tax payment in 1 year. Just pardon my ignorance, Gabriel, but if a billionaire is not getting wage, he's not getting dividends, he's not selling his shares to cash out to get, how is he going out for dinner? How is he having cash in his wallet? How is he buying a new suit?
Yeah. So First, there's a whole industry that creates liquidity for billionaires. And so in practice, they're going to get loans. When they need money for their own consumption, they can borrow a bit of money and they're going to use that for their dinner.
But how do they pay the loan back?
To the movies. And then they pay the loan back, you know, they don't even have to pay them back. They can always borrow because they have so much wealth that they can put as collateral that they don't really need to pay those back. But what's really important to understand, much more important than that, is that for the billionaires, consumption is only a very tiny fraction of their wealth, a very tiny fraction of their income. And so they really need to borrow or to find liquidity to fund their consumption, which is not very big. Like Bezos, his wealth is in the hundreds of billions of US dollars. But his consumption is going to be in the millions because it's very hard to consume more than that in a given year. And so, you know, even if we found ways to tax those loans, because sometimes people say, well, we should simply close that loopholes and make those loans taxable, it wouldn't really address the problem at all because consumption for the very rich is just very, very small compared to their huge economic income or compared to their wealth more broadly.
Okay. So just to be clear, to finish this bit off, where you believe we're falling down is that we're not actually taxing wealth, we're taxing income, which these billionaires are very effective at legally reducing.
True. Yes. The very notion of income is not very well defined for the very rich. Wealth is well defined. Wealth is the value of everything that you own, your houses, your financial assets. For billionaires, it's mostly going to be shares in companies, net of any debt that you have. That's well defined. That's hard to manipulate. That's why if you want to tax the super rich, effectively, you need some kind of tax that's based not on income, because income is so easy to reduce to very low levels, but some kind of tax that's based on wealth.
Gabriel Zucman is my guest. He's professor at the Paris School of Economics, director of the International Tax Observatory, and one of the world's foremost experts on the distribution and the accumulation of wealth. And Gabriel, according to your thesis, and we will get to your tax plan in a moment, but there's more at stake here than just gathering dollars. You argue, and I quote, "With the explosion of the wealth of the super rich has come an explosion of the power to tilt markets, to shape public discourse, to influence policymaking, to stall social progress." And you describe this as a threat to our democracy. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not just me. It's basically all the thinkers of democracy, all the way back to Aristotle, more than 2,000 years ago, who have highlighted this fundamental tension in democratic societies between extreme wealth on the one hand and the very possibility of a well-functioning democracy on the other hand. And the reason is well understood. Wealth, for most people, it's a good thing. It's something we want to encourage. It's owning a house. It's owning your home. It's retirement saving for your old days. So we'd like to encourage wealth accumulation for the middle class. But wealth for the super rich, it's not safety. You know, they don't accumulate billions for their old days. Wealth for them is power, is really the power to, in particular, influence policymaking, to buy elections, to influence the prevailing ideology by buying radio stations and TV channels and so on. And so extreme wealth always means an extreme power. And for some time, especially after World War II, many people forgot about this fundamental tension. And that's because extreme wealth after World War II in many countries had not exactly disappeared, but was really at a low, historically low level. But now, with the explosion of extreme wealth that has started in the 1980s and that's accelerating today, this issue is making come back. At the end of the day, it's a matter of money. It's a matter of who contributes to our common revenue needs, to our collective expenditure on education, on health, on public infrastructure. We need all of that. How can we accept that the middle class is going to contribute a higher fraction of their income to those collective revenue needs than billionaires? That's just not acceptable. Of course, there is a very legitimate debate to have about the proper degree of tax progressivity, meaning the extent to which the rich should pay more tax relative to their income than the rest of the population. And it's normal for people to disagree about that. But no one, almost no one, I think, agrees with the possibility that the wealthiest and most powerful people in society should be allowed to pay less than the rest of the population. That's just a violation of the basic principle of equality before the law. And that's the situation we're in today. And so no matter the merits of those billionaires, this is not something that as a society we can accept.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is global economist Gabriel Zucman. He's professor of the Paris School of Economics and the author of a new book called We Need to Tax Billionaires. So let's flesh out your vision for how to tax the uber rich, Gabriel. What's your plan?
It's a very basic principle that I think everyone agrees with. It's the principle that if you're extremely rich, you shouldn't be allowed to pay zero tax. You should pay a minimum, an unavoidable minimum amount of tax each and every year. That extreme wealth, to put it differently, has to come with unavoidable duties towards society. I think we all agree with that. But what's very weird is that this principle is not written in our laws today. So in our laws, there is nothing that prevents the super rich from paying zero or almost zero. And so making this principle operational means creating an unavoidable minimum tax on the super rich. So that's really the idea that I defend. Now, for the minimum tax to be effective, it has to be expressed not as a fraction of income, it has to be expressed as a fraction of wealth, which is much harder to manipulate. With a minimum tax equal to 2% of wealth for the super rich, you would ensure that the super rich cannot pay less tax than the rest of the population. So this is kind of the basic floor that everybody, no matter whether they're conservative or liberals, right or left, should agree with. You know, the super rich shouldn't be able to pay in personal tax less than 2% of their wealth each and every year. That's the basic proposal that I formulated first for the G20 when the G20 commissioned a report from me in 2024 on this issue. And then this was passed by the French National Assembly last year in 2025 before being blocked by the very conservative Senate. But it will make a comeback. It's now center stage in the French political debate and in a growing number of countries.
And the 2% figure, I think a lot of people listening will go, hang on, I pay 30% or 45% tax, you know. Tell me about the 2%. How did you come to this percentage? The difference here, of course, as you say, it's not on income, it's on wealth. Tell me about the 2% figure and what that would translate into generally.
Oh, yeah, exactly. 2% of wealth is different than 2% of income, of course. And so to understand how big this would be, the number to have in mind is that for the very rich, their income is, roughly speaking, around 6% of their wealth. Or to put it differently, the rate of return on the wealth of the super rich, it's around 6%. Now, if you tax their wealth at 2% of wealth, that would be equivalent to roughly a 33% tax on their incomes. 2 divided by 6, because their income is 6% of their wealth. So we're essentially asking the super rich to pay an income tax, at least around 30% of their income, which is exactly what the upper middle class pays in tax in countries like Australia or in most high-income countries. And that's why this minimum tax equal to 2% of wealth for the super rich would simply ensure that those billionaires would not be able to pay less tax relative to their income than the rest of the population.
And how much difference would it make to the rest of the world? Because this is a global wealth tax you're talking about, isn't it? How much money would it raise, and how would that be distributed? Only within the countries where it was raised, or differently?
Oh, I think any country could do this on its own. So you don't have to do it globally. You don't need an international agreement. Australia could say, we are going to make sure our billionaires pay at least 2% of their wealth in tax each and every year, period. You don't need any other country to agree to that. Mm-hmm. Now, if you compute how much this would generate, if all countries on the planet did that, it would generate a lot of money, because the flip side of the explosion of billionaire wealth is that now there's a very big tax base. There's a lot of government revenue at stake from taxing them. And so we're talking about 400 to 450 billion US dollars in additional tax revenue globally from just this 2% minimum tax on people with more than 100 million US dollars in wealth. And to give a sense of how big this is, if you look at all the money that's spent on international development aid, plus all the money that's spent on all international organizations like the UN and so on, this is of the order of $200 billion. So 0.2% of GDP. With this 2% minimum tax on the super rich, the 3,000 billionaires, you can get twice as much as that, 0.4% of global GDP, 400 billion US dollars each year.
The world has come together before, just 5 years ago, I think, to come up with a multinational tax, a 15% multinational tax. Australia has signed on to that. You mentioned the G20 finance ministers asked you to prepare a report on your 2% minimum wealth tax idea. What would have to happen, Gabriel, for your proposal to get taken up and be made law in a number of countries rather than just isolated countries or states?
The Trump administration is not a big fan of taxing billionaires. And so I'm not expecting any progress at the G20 level in the very short term. I think the way that we'll make some progress is when one country does it on its own and demonstrates that it works. It generates a lot of money from people who are both very rich and undertaxed. And you know what? The sun keeps rising in the morning. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't destroy the economy. And it's the same process that happened for the creation of the income tax at the beginning of the 20th century. It was an international movement, not in the sense of having an international organization doing it in a coordinated manner, but in the sense of different countries experimenting at roughly the same time with progressive income taxation. And the UK did it in 1909, and France in 1914, and so on. And then lots of people were skeptical of income taxation in those days. But those countries demonstrated that it works, and then it became the thing to do, the global standard, the norm. And I think something like that is going to happen in the 21st century with the taxation of the wealth of the super rich. And maybe it's going to start, let me just finish with that, maybe it's going to start with California, because very interestingly, in California, there's going to be a referendum in November, on November 3rd, during the midterm elections in the US, to create a 5% one-time tax on the wealth of California's billionaires. And so the voters will decide in California, and if they vote yes, it will be the first ever billionaire wealth tax enacted anywhere in the world. And it could really start the global movement. And I think it would, very quickly, we would see other countries doing similar policies.
Gabriel, thank you very much for joining me here on the Radio National Hour.
Thank you so much.
That's Gabriel Zucman, professor at the Paris School of Economics, director of the International Tax Observatory, and author of this new book, We Need to Tax Billionaires, which is published by Hachette. It's available for pre-order now or as an audiobook, but if you can wait, it's going to be in the stores from September. And there'll be a longer version of this interview on our website. So if you want to know more about taxing billionaires and what's at stake, or you want to share it with your friends and your family, you can find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, give us a follow, or even better, give us a rating. 5 stars is more than enough, thanks. And fun fact, as we live in the age of the world's first trillionaire, let's put that enormous number in context to just help us get a handle on the magnitude of it. 1 million seconds ago was just under 12 days ago. 1 billion seconds ago was about 32 years ago. It would take us back to 1994. 1 trillion seconds ago was roughly 32,000 years ago, placing us deep in prehistoric times, predating written language and the pyramids. So $1 trillion, folks, is more money that you can count in a lifetime by a factor of huge. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. Superstar violinist Lila Josefovitz was 3 years old when she first picked up the violin, 8 years old when she played her first concerto with an orchestra, and 16 years old when she made her debut at Carnegie Hall. You get my drift. She was a child prodigy. While still in her teens, Lila played all the classics with symphony orchestras across Europe, Asia, and North America. And once she had done so a few times over, she started craving something new, something different, a way of challenging herself, challenging the listener and the status quo. And she's been a champion of contemporary composers around the world ever since. Now, Lila Josefovitz is in Australia and she's touring the country with her longtime collaborator, pianist John Novacek, for Music Aviva this month. Lila, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here.
Lila, I can't imagine learning anything much as a three-year-old, let alone the violin. But when you do begin learning an instrument at such a young age, does it start to feel almost like another limb? Does the violin become like a part of you?
It's definitely a part of me in so many different ways. The discipline is part of me as much as the instrument itself. I don't really remember life without it. And it's a way that I can release much of my imagination and physical and mental energies. So it's something that's definitely, it's part of me in a way that very few things are, I would say.
And if you've played at Carnegie Hall by the time you're 16, you've played with all the major orchestras before you're 20, you've said that your fascination has always been with the learning process. How do you keep learning and changing when you've been playing for most of your life? And what does keeping things new look like to you?
Yeah, well, it's so fascinating when you get to know a new piece of music. As well, of course, get to know the composer who wrote the music. I've had a lot of experiences now over the years with these huge, huge minds and huge personalities. And every single creator is different, and they're writing their own language in a certain way, and they have to dig extremely deep to reach their own language. It's not always something that because I know so many composers, I've been able to talk with them about this over the years. It's not something necessarily that's a natural, feels natural for them or effortless, as people sometimes might think. This is incredible work. And especially when I think a composer is trying to really do something that has never been done before, not kind of maybe take the easy way out and use a language that's already been used in a certain way, or taken a very, very strong influence from another composer, when they're really trying to do something that's out of their own comfort zone, then it's really, really, it's almost like you're wrenching it out of yourself. Yeah. So, but anyway, it's fascinating, fascinating to understand this and get to know the person who's who's writing this, and then myself as the interpreter and as the player tap into places I myself have never been, because each piece is like a new universe.
You're going to be premiering, as I mentioned, Charlotte Bray's piece in Australia, and she's in the middle of composing a concerto for you. You've had a, as you just told us, you've had a number of musical works composed specifically for you. Composers must love it that you actively yearn for these modern compositions, for the new. It must be paying off for you and for them and for the audiences.
You know, this is the seed of great creativity. When one person inspires, when one artist inspires another artist in a certain way, and it bounces back to them from the artist they wrote for or dedicated something to, where it's sort of like this ecosystem of creativity where you have one person that needs, literally needs the other person. Mm. So in this case, the composer really needs the instrumentalist, the artist, the performer, to bring their creation to life and to embody their ideas.
That's a really big responsibility, isn't it? When you are playing something brand new, which doesn't have the fingerprints of other performers on it, how do you approach it? How do you make the work your own? You're the first one to pick up the score and play it. Do you embellish immediately? Does it take time to get to know it? What's that process like?
Well, this is what's so wonderful and challenging about what I'm doing, because constantly you can say to yourself, well, for this piece, my body was used in a certain way to produce this kind of feeling, these kinds of sounds, and these ideas I had to digest. Literally, I had to take time with them to get my perspective on what to do, in simple words. And when I've conquered that challenge in my mind, as far as my abilities and, you know, my thought process, then, of course, it's turned on its head and completely changed with the next composition, with the next composer. So it keeps me forever challenged and never bored. Let's say, I mean, it's just something that, because it's shifting, it's always changing, and the demands are changing, and the sort of the colors, the thought perspective around it is different. And this is what I love to do, really. And despite them changing, I have also, each time I do something different, I'm gaining experience, which is then strengthening me for the next project. So it builds. It's a cumulative building experience.
I love the notion of you strengthening yourself. I mean, you're challenging yourself, but I would say that sometimes with contemporary music, you're challenging us, the audience, too, because I think you describe it as making ugly sounds beautiful, but, you know, sometimes contemporary music has different edges and tones to it that we're not used to. How do you encourage us to be open and to get to love that?
One of the things in my mind is what I think what you just said is making ugly sounds beautiful. But what if we were to kind of eliminate any preconceived ideas about sound and just think that your mind is open to the experience of however a piece will hit you. And also just kind of to relinquish any sort of judgment on what is a beautiful sound, what is an ugly sound per se, as to what society has taught us to believe is beautiful or not beautiful. Then all of a sudden you enter sort of an area of the soul that is free in a certain way. Then all of a sudden, you're not judging maybe in the same ways, nor are you judging your own perceptions. And I know this sounds very kind of cerebral in a certain way, but not in the sense that you just, there's not getting it, did I get it? There's not this kind of thinking. It's more like oh, wow, that was interesting.
Yeah.
Or that was different.
It's about being open, I suppose. Well, you are not going to challenge us in that way today. You're going to play Largo from Bach's Unaccompanied Sonata No. 3, which is obviously not a new work. But just help us out as we listen. What should we be listening out for here?
Sure. I mean, now we're talking about, you know, the greatest genius of 250 years ago, for sure. But I like to think of music as a way of speaking. It's not really about notes. It's not really about pitches per se. There are visions and pictures that and sort of gestures that are more in the forefront of my mind. So I hope it speaks to you, and not only this, but anything I'm playing for you all in Australia on this trip, that it speaks something to you, and I will be very gratified.
I'm sure it will, Leela. I can't wait for this. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
That was Leela Josefovitz, and you can catch Leela with pianist John Novacek in The Fairy's Kiss on tour around the country until the 20th of July. And that's it from me for today. So I hope you can join me tomorrow, because we're going to dedicate the whole show tomorrow to data centres in Australia to try and understand better what's in the pipeline, why communities are so concerned about it, and how they've been pushing back in the US and how the industry is responding to the concerns. And I'd really love to put some of your questions to our guests. So let me know what you think, whether these data centres are going to be in your backyard, or maybe you've got a business or an idea for one that's crying out for this infrastructure. Text me your questions on 0418 226 576, 0418 226 576, or our email address is thehour@abc.net.au.
Have a lovely evening. I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.